Hi, and welcome back. I'm Patrick Polk, and you're listening to The Rules of Investing. This week's guest on the podcast is Tim Tuohy, Chief Economist at the Elliston Global Macro Fund. Tim works alongside Brett Gillespie, who he partnered with to set up the fund. Before joining Elliston, Tim was the Chief Economist and Managing Director at Goldman Sachs and the Head of Macro Strategy for Australia and New Zealand. He has over a quarter of a century of experience as an economist and has one of the best track records around for macro forecasting. In this week's episode, we'll discuss how macro forecasting can add value, why Australia could face recession in the next 2 years, and why the Fed is at risk of being too slow with rate hikes. Finally, if you're loving the rules of investing, then why not tell someone about it? Pick your favourite episode and send it to a friend, or just head on over to iTunes and hit subscribe. Either way, you're helping to increase the profile of the podcast and therefore the quality of the guests that I can bring to you. Well, that's it for now. I hope you enjoy the show. Hi, Tim. Welcome to the show. It's good to have you on.
Hi, Patrick. Good to be here.
There's an awful lot happening in the macro world at the moment, and we're going to get to that a little bit later on. But we've got a lot of equity investors on this show, who listen to this show, I should say. And I think there's a pretty common misconception that I'd love to address with you. I think there's a perception that accurate macro forecasting is either impossible or so difficult to be impractical. So I'd be curious to get your response to that to start with.
Well, I think in the words of Yogi Berra, it's always tough to make predictions, especially about the future. But just because it's tough doesn't mean it's not worth doing. I think the first point would be that if there was no benefit from making a forecast, then there'd be no reason for any manager in any asset class to be thinking about forecastable activity. All the information would already be in the price. So just as an equity manager would be looking at a P&L, going to company meetings, teasing out information from the industry contacts, it's really no different for someone in the macro space. There are meetings, there's data, there are models, and hopefully a good deal of common sense. And all of those go into making the forecast. So I really don't accept that there's much of a difference between a macro forecast or a micro forecast. I think where the criticism probably emanates from is that there is a tendency for economists to step beyond the role of well-researched analysis and into a role where they tend to have a forecast and an opinion on it, on anything. And I think that's where you go beyond the role of an analyst and into the role of some sort of marketing salesman type role. So I think just because it gives people a platform to talk, it doesn't necessarily make them an expert on that particular topic or indeed on anything.
I know one of the things that equity investors, particularly when you're doing a discounted cash flow valuation, for example, one of the things that equity investors focus strongly on is rather than just coming to a single point in a valuation, coming to a range of possible outcomes. Is that the approach that you take as well?
Yeah, look, I think the way I would put that is a lot of people make forecasts, and I think a good forecaster will stick to a process and understand the range of probabilities around that forecast that emanates from their models. So, it's as important to understand the range of possibilities and the range of probabilities together with an understanding of how robust that model actually is that's led to that forecast. The danger is to fall in love with the forecast. Danger is to become overly focused on the accuracy of a particular model rather than using a range of models and isolating the most likely outcome.
As I mentioned before, there's a lot of kind of unusual activities going on in the macro world at the moment. You've got, well, we had central banks starting to pull back on this monetary tightening recently, but that seems to have come to a bit of a pause lately. But I'm curious, what of all the things going on around you in the world right now, what do you think is the most unusual kind of anomaly or situation that you're observing?
Well, let's see. it's a bit of a toss-up, I think, in that regards, between in the US allowing non-financial debt to get above where it got to in 89, or in indeed in the lead-up to the financial crisis, and the developments around leveraged loans in particular, I think, are quite concerning. It does have very similar hallmarks to the subprime crisis, not of the same size, but of the same manufacturing and distribution model, and the lack of regulation. So that certainly concerns me. The other anomaly, I think, that it is that does stand out is, you know, a country like Germany with bonds only, well, really only last night getting back into positive space, despite the fact that their unemployment rate is below that of the US and wages running above that of the US. Those sorts of things, I think, really stand out to me, at least.
Yeah, the bond situation is an unusual one. I think it's people have kind of forgotten about it recently with all the talk of raising rates and, end of QE and all of this. But if I look right now, Austria is still negative out to 6 years. Belgium's still negative out to 6 years. Right across Europe and obviously Japan too, you're still talking long-term bonds that are paying negative yields. It certainly fits the definition of an unusual situation, I think.
Yeah, no, it's in some ways you wonder what are the bond managers actually doing? Is it a representation of what a bond normally is meant to represent, about where some realization of real term growth is, long term growth is, what sort of inflation premium and term premium should be normally embedded, or is it really just a perception of capitalizing in what they see as excessive risks in the system and the belief that there is going to be ongoing quantitative easing to some degree, or indeed a recession just around the corner. Unfortunately, I think for the bond market, a lot of those things I don't think will bear to be true over the next 12 to 24 months. We've obviously seen the Fed already cease its quantitative tightening agenda, but other central banks are not necessarily going to be further escalating their quantitative easing. I think there was a very strong movement in the bond market to bring forward what was always just a loose forecast that 2020 might be a problem year for growth, to the idea that, you know, maybe the recession is going to come a lot earlier globally. And of course, you know, I think the weakness that we saw at the very end of last year and into the start of this year caused an enormous demand for bonds. And then we saw a big convexity trade come through as well that pushed even, if you like, stretched the elastic band even further. So I think as the data improves, as the realization that the recession is not imminent, and of course, as the prospect of near-term rate cuts by major central banks dissipates, I think bonds will have to start to recalibrate where they've got to.
Well, that's obviously looking globally, but let's bring it back to just focusing on Australia for a little bit. Let's start with some data before we get into some of the softer stuff and more of the analysis. What are the most important data points, or if you can boil it down to a single point, even better, that you're keeping an eye on in the Australian economy? And what's it actually telling you at the moment?
Well, I think most people if you ask most people that question, I'm sure they'd answer house prices. I'm not sure that's the right answer. I think if you're thinking about it from a rates and currency type perspective, or even an equity perspective, the RBA have set this up relatively clearly. Any movement in local rates is largely going to come down to what's happening in the employment market. And I think a range of data points are now really pointing to reasonably clear evidence that the employment growth is in the prospect of slowing, or in the process of slowing. Just how slow that or how quickly that comes through in the data will largely determine whether the RBA acts or not. There is this open question as to why employment growth has been so robust while economic growth has been, I think, so slow or so weak. But again, this is where I think, you know, economists and policymakers really haven't thought it through as much as what they could have. It's not that actually unusual when real labour costs are actually below that of productivity growth, which has been the case in Australia for the last 2.5 years. Then it's more economic just to hire new labour rather than pay them more. And in essence, Yeah, that's simple economic theory. It's the way it's meant to work, and it's the way it has worked here. I guess the difficulty here right now is that you've now got a situation where, yes, wages are rising slowly, but the growth slowdown that we've seen over the last couple of quarters is now starting to impact back on productivity. And at the same time, you've got this bout of uncertainty that's globally as well as to some degree locally that might well cause a bit of a pause in employment hiring. And that's pretty evident from the vacancy data, both internet and the ABS official data, and a range of other data points. So it's going to get quite interesting from an employment perspective over the next 3 to 4 months.
The general consensus seems to be that the delay in... let me rephrase that. The general consensus seems to be that the reason that the unemployment has not gone up yet is simply that it's a trailing indicator and that it's delayed some time. I know certainly when I look at the US, it wasn't until during the GFC, that is, it wasn't until well into 2008 that you started to see unemployment really rise. Is that what you think's happening here, or is there something else at play as well?
Yeah, like I said, it is true that that's the case. The labour market always responds with a lag to what you see on the demand front. But in this case, we've gone beyond the period of time when you would have expected it to already have occurred. And hence, that's why I think people have been scratching their heads on it. Now, you know, when you look at the growth trajectory, it does look as though since the middle of last year, the data has clearly slowed. And the Q1 looks as though it's going to be pretty weak again. So, yeah, just from that simple metric alone, you would expect employment growth to slow. And as you can see from some measures of capacity, surveyed measures of capacity utilization, you would expect the unemployment rate to start to tick up a little bit. But if you're a firm and your sales growth is still exceeding your cost growth, you've got a reasonable prospect that adding that unit of labour is still going to be revenue enhancive, you still do that. And that, in essence, is what's been going on, I think. Now, if your expectations about the future suddenly change, then that dynamic changes. And I think this is that's really the question. Can you get a strike, if you like, in terms of employment hiring over the next few months? And I think, that's a realistic possibility that, the slow deterioration in growth that we've seen manifests itself into a faster halt in employment hiring is certainly, I think, a rising probability over the next few months.
So would the indicators to watch there be the ANZ jobs data and the NAB business confidence survey? Would that be the ones you'd be keeping an eye on?
Well, they're important ones. The NAB confidence series tends to lead the conditions series. So the conditions went up, confidence is still falling. So, that's probably meaningful. Yes, the ANZ job series is an important one. I think the SEEK job series data has got a lot more focus in the market. The RBA has put a lot more focus on the ABS vacancies data because that's the one that has been strong and certainly is strong in level terms, and it actually still did increase last quarter. But the pace of increase has been slowing, and the more private sector cyclical parts of the economy are actually in decline. And in areas like construction will likely fall quite a lot more. So I think over the next quarter or two, it's going to move negative year on year, and the RBA will have to shift their opinion on what that survey is telling you about the strength of the labour market, if they haven't already.
There's obviously a lot of headwinds for the Australian consumer, but I'm curious, how do you think they're holding up? As obviously you've got the housing market creating a negative wealth effect and a lack of wages growth. Yep. How does the Australian consumer survive from here, I guess?
Well, I think it's been volatile and they're performing relatively poorly. If you're looking just purely at the consumption data, which is more robust than the retail sales data, it's not quite as volatile and it's broader. It's still the worst 6-month performance in over 5 years, and clearly slowing. And the more discretionary elements of that consumption basket are slowing relative to the things you have to spend your money on. So that's obviously not great. Retail's expanding at about a 3% rate. Ex-food, it's about 2%. Over the last few months, ex-food's annualizing at negative 1%. Yeah, is that great? Well, obviously not. That's pretty poor. It's been interesting that confidence, which has been ebbing, but not falling away precipitously despite the house price declines. So it's held up reasonably well. And, you know, despite the fact that there hasn't been much by way of wage growth, there has been a pickup in bonuses and those sorts of things. So household income was buffeted up to that degree, but then the tax take by the government increased, stripped a lot of that away. So after-tax income actually hasn't done that much. So it's, I think the difficulty that you've got is, I think the RBA could have made a bit of a narrative, and they were making the narrative that, look, any wealth impact from falling house prices was going to be upset by the likely increasing housing income, household income, after-tax income. Yes, you'll get a fill-up out of the budget. Cash handouts tend to get spent almost immediately. You know, we always see it in the gaming stocks and a few other things pretty immediately. But the impact of income tax cuts, well, there's still uncertainty as to which form will be delivered. And the lesson last time was that a large component of an income tax cut ended up being saved in the first instance. So, look, a lot more has to happen in terms of that income side in order to feel confident that the consumer is going to remain robust enough, at least until, you know, the worst of the house price declines and the wealth effect is behind us.
So is it safe to say that you're expecting the next move from the RBA from here to be down?
I think the bounce, yes, so we are. In January, we moved to that view. And you know, there was a range of reasons for that. There's, you know, a host of the, you know, higher frequency data points were already at levels that were consistent where the RBA had eased in the past. You know, the large fall in an NAB survey was, you know, material. You couldn't ignore the signal that that was sending, albeit, you know, the magnitude did look outsized. And of course, you know, falling house prices in and of themselves isn't really a reason to ease. But if you continue the path we're on, you know, what you move towards is not just an idea of, is it a linear sort of transformation between a wealth effect, or do you hit some sort of non-linear barrier where you get outsized movements or outsized adjustments? And I think, you know, if you want to take it to the extreme, then if, you know, on our estimates, if net housing wealth fell another 20%, the household savings rate would have to go up by about 4.5%. Now, that would risk a pretty severe slowdown. So that's not our base case.
Could I get you just to explain why it is that that increase in the household savings rate might be so negative for the economy?
Yeah, so the household saving rate is not how much wealth they actually have, it's just how much they've got left over after they, what they're paid versus what they actually consume in a particular period in time. But if you find that your wealth is falling away, you tend to think, well, my gearing is involuntarily rising. And one way to address that is to try and save a little bit more out of income each period. If you do that, then obviously that has some flow back through into weaker consumption spending, ultimately employment, and then it multiplies through the rest of the economy. Now, it's fine if that's only happening on a sort of incremental movement period to period. But when collectively people come to the realization that this is becoming unstable and we're not quite sure where the bottom is, you can get these larger adjustments in behavior. Now, again, you know, it's not our base case, and the consumer confidence type data is suggesting that things are still relatively controlled and benign just now. But it is a risk. And if you're a policymaker, why would you run that risk? You know, your modus operandi is to think of it in terms of policy of least regret. So if you can forestall that risk from emanating, then you'd probably would take out that insurance.
Speaking of the policy of least regret, in the past, that kind of approach seems to have taken the RBA to cutting when the housing market has turned down. They've obviously taken a bit of a different approach this time, and they've not yet responded to that. Why do you think there's the difference this time? And just as a follow-on too, do you think that cutting at this point is actually going to have any much of an effect on the housing specifically?
Well, I think the rationale for not cutting, I think, was reasonably clearly articulated by the governor. I mean, in his mind, house prices and the level of household debt are excessive. And, you know, some gradual deflation in house prices relative to GDP or income or wages is warranted, and, you know, absolutely concur with that. In fact, I think what people probably don't realise is that if house prices continue to fall at their current pace, by early 2020, some of those metrics that everyone likes to point to about Australia, like house price to income type ratios, which have been elevated, will be back at their average since 2000 by the early part of 2020. So it doesn't take that long with income growth doing what it's doing at the moment and house prices falling at this current rate of slightly under 1% per month. We'll certainly sort of bring those ratios back to something that looks a little bit more reasonable. I think the shift in the mindset is that that's starting to emanate is the risk around, well, A, wages probably aren't picking up as fast as they'd hoped, and B, you can see that the concerns around housing continue to build, and it's starting to emanate and spill over into areas like a bigger fall off in construction, which we think will take about 150,000 to 170,000 jobs out of the economy. So, you know, that can and historically has happened reasonably quickly. So you will need a lot of other areas of the economy to, you know, pick up some slack. Accelerate, if you like, just to keep the labour market steady. So to do that without policy relief is a little bit of wishful thinking.
So that's, sorry, just quickly doing maths in my head. That's a bit short of 1% increase in unemployment there, just from the. Is that right? Yeah.
Well, no, it would be in terms of the labour market. You have to assume that there's also a base load of people that needs, or base load of employment that needs to be met just from the rising labour force month to month as well. And you know, the economy is always expanding as well. So you wouldn't just translate that straight into a rise in the unemployment rate of that order of magnitude. And of course, also the participation rate always changes. Into and around a slowdown, people just remove themselves from the workforce if they think there's not a realistic prospect that they can get a job. But I think the other dynamic around this, which I think is probably the most important one for why the RBA may ultimately move, is that by the middle part of last year, they had a realistic prospect that they would get inflation back to the lower end of their target band, and that's their statutory mandate. As things have evolved, the way the data has slipped away and now the fall in house prices have occurred, they're already at the longest period of time where they haven't been able to get inflation back into their target band in the history of inflation targeting. Now, if the prospect even not getting into that band is slipping away month by month, then they actually do have something of a statutory mandate to try and do something about it. So you can ask the question, will it actually have an impact if they cut rates? Well, it will have more of an impact than doing nothing. And if they can calibrate it in the way that it's a little bit of more of a surprise and preemptive, it'll have a larger impact.
Well, it's always a dangerous game, but let's try and put a bit of a time frame on it if we can. Base case, what would you be expecting as in terms of when the first RBA cut may come?
Look, our base case has been since January that it would turn up in August, but with the risk that it could come earlier. And I still think that's a realistic prospect. Now, we have seen some better data points in the last few days in and around things like trade and a little bit of a better monthly retail read. But the reality is of what will be the sort of rate determining step for the RBA will be the employment print, which is from when we're talking today, or what's on the 18th of this month, and then the CPI print, which is, I think, is the 24th of this month. Now, a miss on the employment will certainly raise the odds. If it's then followed by a relatively weak inflation print, it's going to be pretty hard for them to stand still, even though that would be in the middle of an election campaign. So I think there is also what we know in this country, at least, is that there's a tendency of the data to disappoint into an election. Now, if you split the data from when it's expected that the incumbent government's going to hold power, and that's where the odds are heavily skewed, then you tend to find the data doesn't fall away very much. But when there's a large expectation of a shifting government and some very different policies being announced, you tend to find that data does slip away. So the RBA's intent may not be to go still and not to go during the election campaign. And it's still our base case that they just avoid that. But they could easily move to an easing bias at the next opportunity. and then deliver very soon after that.
So where does China fit into all this? There's obviously, it was a very well publicized downturn in China towards the end of last year and some negative data coming through towards the beginning of this year. So how important is the situation in China going to be to the outcome for Australians?
Well, I think, as everyone knows, China's enormously important for Australia. It's number one export partner, number one import partner. So it's obviously our number one trading partner. Around about $110 billion of exports goes to China from Australia. Half of that's iron ore alone. Services side's about another $17 to $18 billion. Most of that being education and tourism. So, incredibly important. But I think the difficulty that I think people have in calibrating the China view is that it's been part of a deliberate strategy to slow things in China, as we've all read widely about, and then it's been escalated by the blowback from the interruption in global trade from the tariff concerns. And that really magnified the degree of slowdown, not just in China, but elsewhere. Now, what I think people have kind of failed to grasp is just how much China's actually shifted. From a fiscal point of view, on my count at least, it's the range of policies that have been announced since the start of October sum up to 3% of GDP, China's GDP. Now, I'm not pretending that's all going to happen in 2019, and I'm not pretending it'll all be enacted, but to put it into some sort of context, that's in the global financial crisis, the enormous stimulus that they imparted that helped bail out this country was about 12% of GDP. So it's pretty big. You've also seen a very large pivot in the monetary stimulus. If you look at where their short-term interest rates have actually gone to and what tends to happen historically to growth in the period afterwards, it's reasonable to feel reasonably confident about what China actually does over the next couple of quarters at least. And I think we're starting to see that in some of the data globally. So I'm actually reasonably upbeat about the degree of stimulus that they've imparted and ultimately what that means. Unfortunately, that might mean that the A-dollar goes for a bit of a run to the upside, though, if the RBA doesn't actually, try and hold it back by moving dovishly and potentially easing. So we need to be somewhat mindful of that. But ultimately, the stimulus that's been imparted there in China is important. We're seeing the Europeans respond in terms of stimulus as well. Financial conditions more broadly, globally, and in major economies like the US, are easier now than what they were in September of last year before the market rout even commenced.
Switching back to the housing market for a second, there's been some capital controls implemented in China in recent years. I'm curious, how much of that do you think, how much, if any, of a role do you think that's playing in the housing downturn that we're seeing in Australia? There's obviously been a huge fall off in foreign investment. Do you think that's been a major driver?
Yeah, I do. I think I've been on the record over the years of saying that, let's put it this way. When we were looking at the number of foreign investment review approvals to buy residential property through time, it's always been about 0.2 to a quarter of a percent of the housing stock approved each year. From the 2014-2016 period, the capital flight, private sector capital flight out of China was the biggest movement of capital out of a country in the post-war period. So it had to be absorbed somewhere. We saw a host of housing markets respond, not just Australia, but Canada, some of the Nordics, obviously the UK, parts of the US, all responded in tandem. So in terms of that increase in foreign approvals, it went from 0.25% of the housing stock to almost 2.5% of the housing stock in the space of 2 years. It's now gone back to 0.25%, of the housing stock very quickly. So, that's an enormous influence, not just in terms of people turning up at auctions and putting up their hands. It's also, obviously impacted price. It's impacted the willingness of developers to provide the supply. And as that foreign source of demand dissipates, then of course builders and developers have to recalibrate and the excesses that got into the price have to normalize out. And ultimately that's largely what's happened. I mean, this is a housing construction downturn and a price downturn that has nothing really to do with the RBA. You can talk about credit restrictions out of the Royal Commission, and there is an element of truth to that. I think it's been, you know, somewhat overplayed of that role in of itself. I would always and have always put far more focus on the role of, you know, this exogenous shock by foreign demand to housing rather than actually the credit controls. But when you put the two together, they're quite powerful in terms of not just recalibrating where the price should be, but also, you know, recalibrating longer term expectations of where prices go.
Do you think it's possible that the Chinese buyers come back into the Australian market, or are the capital controls there going to prevent that now, do you think?
I don't think it's possible that you'll see the same magnitude. You won't see the same flight. I think it's much, much more difficult for them to get out large sums of capital in the time frame. And I think also that you have to ask the question of why would you, when house prices in China are actually going up at a reasonable clip. Depending whether you're looking at first tier or second tier cities, you know, the double digit gains to be had versus double digit declines to be had here. So you'd have to be taking a strong view on the A-dollar, I think, and a much more pessimistic view on the outlook for the Chinese economy for that capital to want to exit, if it could. And I think, as you rightly point out, Patrick, it's not clear they can actually get it out in the orders of magnitude that can be as meaningful as the first time around.
So just before we move on from the subject of Australia, there's one last thing I wanted to ask you. Looking out over the next 2 years, what do you think are the chances that we see a recession in Australia?
On a two-year time frame, it's certainly possible. And I think the main catalyst that will come from, normally it's an external shock that helps drive that, or it's a massive policy error. In this case, it's more likely to come via the developments in housing cascading back through consumption, or, you know, a material misstep in the prospects of China. I'm not as bearish, though, as I think a lot of people like to be on this. I think it's quite feasible that in the experience of Australia looking forward, that some of what we have is a bit of a coiled spring. I don't think that the response of the Australian economy to a relatively okay global trading environment is going to diminish rapidly. So I think that external shock is not going to be present. I think fiscally the pivot is going to be to deliver more stimulus locally. I think the housing downturn and construction downturn that we're likely to see related purely to housing will be somewhat mitigated by what we're seeing from government delivered policies in infrastructure spend, not completely. So I think you can get a slower growth trajectory with some policy support, RBA helping into this regard as well, without actually getting a recession. Mainly the reason why I'm saying this is you already have navigated some quite acute global shocks, global trade, China slowdown, house prices declining quite sharply without a precipitous fall in the things that we kind of care about for when a recession would come about, i.e. huge falls in confidence. Thus far, it's been reasonably well controlled.
Well, let's move on from Australia and China for a bit. There is another major economy in the world that we've failed to discuss in any great detail so far. So obviously, as we discussed earlier, the Fed's paused at the moment on their rate hiking, and they've scaled back the quantitative tightening measures that they had been implementing. This obviously was a response to the downturn that we saw at the end of last year. So from here, what do you think it would actually take to see the Fed start raising rates again?
Well, in truth, probably not too much. I think you need to go back to think about what the Fed has done and why it did it. The main reason the Fed pivot, or the power pivot, occurred was in response to the tightening financial conditions. And I know for most people, they think about that in terms of what led that was just equity prices declining. But the reality is the thing that caused financial conditions to tighten the most in the US when you decompose it, it was the blowing out in credit spreads. That's what ultimately caused them to reassess. Now, as I already said, financial conditions have actually rebounded above where they were at the start of October and are back to pretty much where they were at the start of September of last year. So they've fully moved on from that perspective. And of course, you've also, the pivot was also in response to what that would imply for growth and ultimately how the growth picture started to shape up at the start of the year. So when growth was running at 3.5 to 3.25 annualized, the tightening financial conditions was telling us, at least, that it was set to slow to about 1.5%. You know, the recovery that we're seeing is suggesting now that it should be growing about 2.25%. So it's quite a material shift already in terms of the incremental growth. I think what's also important there is that as the shutdown occurred, the adverse weather occurred, the deterioration in sentiment around the trade policies occurred, the Fed took that on board. Now, I would also stress that this Powell Fed has continued to shift the goalposts. They are a little bit at war with their own staff. The staff clearly believe still in Phillips curves, and they still believe in wage pressures ultimately translating into inflation pressures. Powell continues to dismiss that and suggests that inflation is very well behaved. Well, core inflation is still actually above 2% at the moment. Oil prices are now up 45% from the low. Wage pressures are continuing to escalate. You only have to look at any company report in the US and see them all basically uniformly pointing to wage pressures as a significant source of pressure on their margins. There's plenty of inflationary pressures still in the US economy. Now, as the data rebounds, and it looks like that's starting to occur, and we're actually relatively upbeat what happens in Q2 and Q3 of this year for the US, it's going to be pretty hard for the Fed to hold its narrative. But it's also important, the narrative that they're on hold or may well ease. But it's also important to remember that they've shifted what they're targeting. Powell is targeting the rate of change in the data and the shape of the yield curve. So we now have a Fed that will not be preemptive. We have a Fed that will be reactive, and they're going to be listening to the market, potentially listening to the president, and hopefully not being too slow to recognize when the inflationary pressures actually build through. So I don't really believe the Fed is going to ease. I think the data is going to be sufficiently strong and the inflationary pressures sufficiently high that ultimately they'll be signaling that they're still on hold until the yield curve shows them an appropriate trajectory. And it's important to point out that the yield curve is already starting to steepen up anyway, but it will take them some time before they actually say, okay, that's sufficient steepness and the data is sufficiently robust that maybe we can consider one last hike. But the clock's ticking because they can't be too late or too slow. They can't be too early because they will want to see that data in the rearview mirror improving, and they can't be too soon in the sense of the time frame to the 2020 election. So it really only leaves them around if they're going to hike again. Maybe Q4 of this year is pretty much their only opportunity.
Reading a little bit between the lines of what you're saying there, Does it seem accurate that the risk seems skewed more towards them potentially being a bit too late to raise rates rather than being too early at this stage?
Well, I think there's a very strong parallel, and I think even Powell is aware, and his staff are certainly aware, that although they don't believe yet that the Phillips curve has started to steepen up, they do believe that if you take the unemployment rate down sufficiently far, you get a nonlinear response, and that's when the Fed has to go back to being preemptive. And we saw that in the late 60s in particular. Now, the Fed's own staff believe that pivot point, if you believe their own research they've put out in the last couple of years, and we've replicated some of it, that's around about here, at these sort of levels, that you tend to get that nonlinear response in the unemployment rate through to wages and inflation. So it's kind of ironic that the Fed has moved to a view that, no, we're in this state of the world where wages can continue to go up, and that is a good thing, and it won't ever really spill into inflation. And we'll only ever respond to it once it actually, the Phillips curve looks like it's, we've gone around the corner effectively. It's really steepening up. The history has shown that if when you start to get very reactive and backward looking, you tend to be too late. So there is this risk. Yeah, it's, I'm not pretending this is a near-term risk. It's more of a, let's go forward at 12 to 18 months risk, that the Fed convinces itself that the best thing that they can possibly do is just continue to stand still and sound really dovish. It'll build up financial sector risks. It'll build up some latent inflation risks. And it becomes harder to get those things back out of the system if you don't have an appropriate risk premium on your risk assets, an appropriate interest rate policy.
Well, this is actually the end of the main part of the interview, but there's actually a few favourite questions that I like to ask each of my guests. Now, we're getting close to the end of our time here. Have you got another 5, maybe 10 minutes to stick around and go through the favourite questions?
Sure.
Excellent. Cool. So first of all, could you share with us something that you've read recently? It could be a book, an article, or a piece of research that really surprised you or impressed you or, just left you speechless afterwards.
There's lots of things that do that, actually. But I think, if I had to really say what was the one or collection of books that I've read that surprised me. We've all probably read the number of Trump-type books that have come out in the last 12 months. I think I've read 4 or 5 of them now. The things that surprised me is that you don't get a different picture from reading 200 or 300 pages in a book to what you've picked up from the mayhem and chaos just from the media day to day. So the surprise is there doesn't appear to be an overarching plan or an apparatus or institutional support behind the decision making, and that is both concerning and surprising.
Yeah, you've got to smile and laugh a little bit, I think, because otherwise it's a bit too scary to properly comprehend. So if you could go back in time to when you were finishing school or university and give yourself one piece of investing advice, what would it be?
Probably should have been learn Chinese. It would have made the life of an economic forecaster and strategist a hell of a lot easier, because the signals, I think for people in the equity community probably don't realise as much as they probably could, is that if you're looking at the Australian earnings cycle and compare it to global and developed market, the US, the one that it's most heavily correlated with by far is the Chinese earnings cycle. And it's, even when you strip out resources, it's quite remarkable. So, the point is that, we're increasingly getting tied to that. So, the economic signal is increasingly coming to the north of us rather than to the east or the west of us. And I think that's, super important. If you go back in time, it makes it a hell of a lot easier as the Chinese markets open and some of their discussion points and speeches and policy pivots are announced to absorb that in real time. So I think that would be important. Probably also just learning the virtues of compound interest and having that heavily ingrained at an early age is something we could all probably give our children.
I normally ask my guests for a stock pick at this point in the interview, but it didn't seem appropriate to ask you of that. So looking out over the next 5 years, what do you think is the biggest risk that the global economy faces?
Well, we've never seen a global population age to the extent that we're going to see it age over the next 5 years. So that's obviously a well-trodden risk. So, but also, it's a data point of one. We really don't know the full impacts of how that's going to play through despite best endeavours. So that should always be front of mind. But realistically, I think the biggest risk that exercises my mind the most is that globally, if this movement to the political right continues and the erosion of the political institutions and structures and, if you like, belief systems that have helped ensure multi-decades of peace globally and economic prosperity, it'll be eroded, and it can erode pretty quickly. So we've got some European elections coming up. They may not be the catalyst for it, but I imagine that if this movement towards the right continues, it will feed into, you know, things like equity risk premia or risk premia in other assets as well, because something probably does have to be embedded for the risk that, you know, these institutions continue to be corroded.
Sobering thought. Well, Tim, thanks so much for coming on the show. It's been great to share your insights or hear your insights and get your view on the economy today.
Pleasure. Pleasure being here.